Hi, my name is Sam Williams. Welcome to part two of episode number 174 of my 60 music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Hello, so first of all, I'd like to welcome all you to part two of episode number 174 of my 60 music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or on iHeartRadio, or on Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is I'm going to give you descriptions of what this is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 26-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a 60 music fan slash expert slasher, and each week with this podcast, I take one song by one artist and stick each of the show in two parts. First part is how to talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good, or why I think it sucks, and do my own personal analysis on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chords, my lyrics, and second part of the show deep into the history behind that track. In that part of the show, talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, what studio the song was recorded at, talk about the session players who played on the song, talk about the songwriters that wrote it, the producer that produced it, and the peak position of the song we had originally on Billboard Hot 100 charts when it first came out, talk about the history behind the artists that recorded the song, and the history behind the studio the song was recorded at, where the studio is located at, and a label released the label the song is released on, the year month the song is released. All that is in the second part of this show. Now, before we move on to this week's episode of the podcast, I just want to say, again, I'm super excited to keep doing this podcast into the next year and keep putting out these free episodes, but please subscribe to the premium subscription version of this podcast. I have two really cool interviews coming out this month for the premium subscription version, so you're definitely going to want to listen to those because those interviews are fantastic. They're really, really informative, really, really good. I definitely recommend subscribing to the premium subscription version of this podcast because the more premium subscribers I get, the more I'll be able to pay for next year too, so that's really, really cool. So please go do that. I really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the premium subscription version of this podcast. They'll get six really good podcast interviews. There's four out right now, but there's two coming out very, very soon. We'd love if you can do that. That'd be great. I mean, these interviews are just amazing. So much good information in these interviews. They're just fan-freaking-tastic. Okay. Also, an update. I'm almost done recording my next EP. This weekend, the lead guitar for the long extended version of Turquoise Apricot is getting recorded. I'm going to hear that very, very soon. I haven't heard what the guitar player has done yet, but I'm imagining it's going to sound amazing. I cannot wait, to hear what the long version sounds like the lead guitar parts, and then basically going to go in and do lead vocals and background vocals for the rest of the songs, and then the EP is recorded. It's done being recorded, and then it's off to mixing and mastering, and then it'll be out. So I'm very, very excited. I'll keep you guys posted. Also, the music video for Turquoise Apricot, I think I mentioned this before last week. I'm re-recording the song right now, so we might try to sync up the music video to the new version of the song once that's done and recorded. So it might be a while before you see that music video, but I did shoot it, so hopefully that'll be cool and we can try to come up, whip up something for that. But anyways, yeah, so let's get started in this week's song. Moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's artist and song. And that song was called Look of Love, and the name of the artist was called Leslie Gore. Now, more importantly, let's talk about the Brill Building again, because we haven't talked about the Brill Building in a while. And it's a very interesting scene in New York City in the early 60s that isn't as talked about as much in the mainstream as the Greenwich Village folk scene. I mean, yes, you had the Bob Dylans, the Pete Seegers, and the Peter Palmieri's, and that whole thing, you know, the Phil Oaks and the Tim Hardens and like all that. That whole Greenwich Village folk scene, which is cool, which is really a good part of New York City. But the Brill Building was a scene that was so magical and so competitive and so emotional that it's definitely worth talking about because so much amazing music came out of this scene, and it was a scene that was dominating the popular music industry in the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, it's just amazing the amount of hits that came out of the Brill Building in New York. But let's talk about that because, you know, it was a very interesting sort of thing, right? Because There is actually, when I say the Brill Building, I'm talking about two different buildings, actually. I'm referring to the building on the Broadway and 49th Street. The address of that building was 1619th Broadway. That building was, in fact, the Brill Building. And then there's another building on Broadway and 51st Street. That building, the address of that building is 1650 Broadway. And both of these buildings came up with hundreds and hundreds of hit songs, but they were different and they were unique, and the separation between the 1619 Broadway, which is the Brill Building, and 1650 Broadway right up the street on 51st Street, and the 1619 Broadway is on the corner of Broadway and 49th, was that the older, more established writers, or more or less the writers that were sort of at the tail end of the Tin Pan Alley generation, that weren't old enough to have worked in Tin Pan Alley, but were, you know, young enough to have been there, weren't old enough to have actually been a Tin Pan Alley songwriter, but they're also old enough to have been around when those songs were being recorded and those songs were hits. Those songwriters who were sort of at the tail end of that, and I'm talking about guys like Mac David and Sherman Edwards and Ben Raleigh, Ben Wiseman. I mean, just those songwriters that were sort of at the tail end of the Tin Pan Alley generation coming, you know, the songwriters that are writing songs for Disney. I mean, Mac David's a great example of this. Mac David was Hal David's older brother. He was very much a part of this older generation of songwriters, too, and he wrote songs like, he wrote the lyrics to So This Is Love, and he also, wrote Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo for Cinderella and a couple songs for Alice in Wonderland. So Mac David was very much a part of this scene in New York, but those writers are mainly writing out of 1619 Broadway. And also this is true for writers like Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann and Lee Bernstoller and other writers. They were mainly writing out of 1619 Broadway. Famous Music, which was Bacharach and David's publishing company, that was out of 1619 Broadway. So that way you know the difference, right? 1619 Broadway was more for the older established writers, again, like Hal David, Sherman Edwards, Ben Raleigh, people like that. I mean, and also Mac David and, you know, songwriters who are more on the older end of the spectrum, who weren't really big into rock and roll. But then you had 1650 Broadway right down the street, and that was where all the young, hot songwriters who were just getting out of high school and just really into the rock and roll of the 50s and were craving to create sort of their own version of what was big in rock and roll in the late 50s, early 60s. I mean, all the young, hot songwriters who were just, you know, the teenagers from Brooklyn, those songwriters were writing out of 1650 Broadway. Because that's where Alden Music was based out of. And Alden Music was a company, a publishing company owned by two guys, Don Kirshner and Al Nevins. Don Kirshner was not a musician. He did not know how to read music. He did not know how to play a musical instrument. He couldn't sing. But he had a musical ear where he knew hit songs when he heard them. And Al Nevins was also a singer and a musician. He was actually in a group in the 30s and 40s that had pretty big hits on the pop charts called the Three Sons. So he came from more the big band jazz sort of world, you know, the big band pop world of the 30s and 40s. But he managed to adapt with the times as rock and roll was sort of the new thing that was going to be a permanent sort of fixture in the popular music landscape. So he adapted to that and formed a publishing company with Don Kirshner, and they called the company Alden Music, and they were based out of 1650 Broadway. And that sort of building, that's where they nurtured very young, inexperienced but willing to get hits and willing to get their feet wet into the music business as songwriters. That's where they nurtured very young songwriters who were competitive, they were full of emotions, and they were just full of just really powerful sort of, like, you know, they knew what they wanted to say, and they really got in there and they just wrote all these huge hit songs. And those writers were Jerry Goffin and Carole King, Barry Manson, The Wild, Neil Sedaka, and Howard Greenfield. Jeff Barry, Nellie Greenwich. They were writing out a trio of music, which I believe was in 1650, and which is Lieber and Stoller's publishing company. But all the young writers, like Howie Greenfield, Jack Keller, Roger Atkins, Tony, what's his name? The guy who wrote 90.6, Tony Powers, Beverly Ross, all the young songwriters who were basically Helen Miller. I mean, all these young, songwriters who were basically really trying to sort of get into the headspace of the young American teenagers, who are really trying to just sort of get into the mindset of the teenage girls who are buying these records. And that's who was buying most of, 45s back then. It was mostly teenage girls. So they wanted to dive into the teenage psyche of these women who were buying these 45 records back then. And those were the songwriters that were doing it. I mean, you had, Burt Burns too, and Bob Feldman, Jerry Goldstein, and Richard Gotherer, and all these different writers who were all kind of working under one roof in 1650 Broadway. And it was just a very interesting scene, because this was before, there was such a thing as singer-songwriters. Because nowadays, if you sing songs, you're almost expected to also write them. And while that was starting to happen in the 60s, I mean, you had, Paul Anka, you had Del Shannon, and you had Neil Sedaka, and you had Sam Cooke, and there were a lot of singers that were writing songs. They weren't like the singer-songwriters you would think of today, with the guitar and the voice and the sort of intimate, sort of like very personable songwriting aspect of their songs. I mean, that really didn't happen until the early 70s. But at this time, most singers at this point were not writing their own songs. So therefore, they needed to rely on young songwriters to write music for them, And that's when these songwriting teams got together. They got into these little cubicles, and one person would do the lyrics, one person would do the music. They would come together, and they would write all these songs, and then they would basically go into a demo studio, in which it was either be Dick Charles or Associated or one of those demo recording studios, and they would go in there, and they would basically record a demo of the song. And the demo of the song would be exactly how they would want it to be recorded. The songwriters would come up with the arrangements, and they would basically, and sometimes they would ask the musicians to come up with something too. If they were stumped and they couldn't figure out what to do for a certain part, they would ask the musicians to come up with something, and then the songwriters would get together, and then they would the arrangements of these songs, the core arrangements for them, were basically birthed in these demo recording sessions, right? And a lot of times they were as simple as a piano vocal arrangement, and sometimes they were very complicated. You had piano, vocal, guitar, bass, and drums, and it was a full rhythm section going on, and those were demos too. But the main thing to keep in mind about this is that when they would go into the studio to record these demos, it's very important to understand that some of these demos did wind up getting released as records. But most of the time, these demos never really got released, and a lot of times the songwriters did sing on these demos, or they would get a demo singer like Ron Dante or Tony Orlando. But a lot of times these songwriters did sing on their demos. But the thing to keep in mind is that even though a lot of these demos didn't get released, when these demos got recorded and they would basically present these demos to the publishers. The publishers would try to shop these demos around to different producers like Steph Garrett or Al Kasha or Phil Spector or Mickey Most or Quincy Jones. When they would hear these demos, most of the time they would retain every single aspect of the demo for the master recording of the song, when the song would get redone as the master. Basically they would copy the demo. They wouldn't change a thing about it. And that's something that's a very powerful thing when it came to, the songwriters at this time. The songwriters are really the ones that had all the control. They had all the power, because all the arrangers did was that all they did is they took their original demo. All they did was just, embellish it by basically, creating a full arrangement, with horns and strings and background singers and percussion and all these different things, but everything would be based off of the original demo of the song. And you know, they would even copy some, even when Carole King would go in the studio or associate or Dick Charles, and he would and she would play all these different melodic things on the piano, the arranger would hear that and basically create horn parts based off, or like string parts based off of that sort of, those sort of patterns that were played by Carole King when she would go in the studio to record herself playing piano for you know, these rough demos that she would record. And basically, the main thing to keep in mind is that the songwriters had all the power, because what they did is that they went in the studio to record these demos, but the initial arrangements for these songs were essentially copied from the original demos. So the arrangements for the master recordings of these songs were more or less just like the original demos. They weren't any different. I know this because I've heard a lot of those demos from a lot of those real building songwriters. And to be honest with you, minus from the very poor sound quality of these demos, right, which is obvious because those demos were recorded on acetate tape. And acetate was this biodegradable form of tape that if you play it for too many times, the tape would degrade and you would only get so many plays out of an acetate reel to reel, you know, tape. You know, basically, you'd only get so many plays out of a tape. So aside from the very poor quality of these demos, which is fine because these songs weren't meant to be released anyways, the main thing to keep in mind is that even though these songs didn't get released as officially because they weren't supposed to, the master recordings were just like the demos. I mean, more or less, they would copy the same, like, whatever parts the musicians are playing on the demos, the same exact musicians that got the call for the master recording session for the song would copy the exact same parts the musicians that were playing on the demos were playing. So when the songs got re-recorded as masters, most of the time the arrangers would just copy whatever the musicians were doing on the demos, and they would just have the players on the master recording sessions play the exact same parts. And everything was just like the demo. Nothing was, there weren't really any changes. And, you know, it's funny because, yes, sometimes lyrics got changed. Yes, that did happen from the demo to the master. But for the most part, the musical arrangers would stay the same. And that was the essence of the Brill Building in New York. And you know, things, a lot of this got shaken up by the Beatles and the British Invasion. But luckily, a lot of these British Invasion bands needed songs to record because they weren't good songwriters themselves. So therefore, they got to record a bunch of songs by Brill Building songwriters. You know, I've talked about this before and talked about the British Invasion. But really, the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the Brill Building was such a very competitive, very just really, really just not it was a space where it was supportive, right? Because a lot of these writers support each other, they bounce ideas off each other, but it was also competitive too, because all these songwriters are competing for cuts, for songs to make, for them to become hits. So there was a lot of jealousy that happened between, you know, songwriters. I mean, very much these people were like, dude, like when they often got mad at each other when they found out that their song was going to get cut by someone else. You know, and that they didn't want, and or a writer got a hit with one artist and they couldn't get a hit with them. I mean, it was a very competitive atmosphere, but it was very a lot of high emotions too, because a lot of these songwriters are emotionally complex people that had a lot of issues. But you know, the amount of talent that went into recording these songs was unbelievable. I mean, everyone from the musicians that played on the recordings to the arrangers, to the engineers, to the producers, to the singers. I mean, there was so much talent that got put into these records. It's unbelievable. Now let's talk about Leslie Gore. Okay, so before I get into the history behind Leslie Gore, I thought this would be a cool time to really dive into, or at least make a really draw a good comparison between 60s music and right now in the music industry. Because, I mean, look, it's going to be tough for me to, you know, make the comparison between Leslie Gore's music and someone who's out right now. Because, let's face it, like, for the most part, except for probably Silk Sonic, most mainstream music in today's world is so far away from the 60s, it's not even funny. I mean, the it's just, we're so completely removed from music from this time that saying there's a modern artist that sounds like, you know, an artist like Leslie Gore is just, there's just this kind of music. They don't make this kind of music anymore. You're just not going to hear anything like this right now. But I will say this. I will say that Leslie Gore and the whole brand behind her music and sort of her personality and everything about it, you hear echoes of that in today's world. And more importantly, you heard also echoes of that, of her kind of style, more not necessarily her style, but more just the whole idea of a teenage girl singing about boys. You know, it's funny because, like, just thinking about that, I mean, this is something that we have always been a fan of. We've always been fascinated with teenage girls singing about boys, and that is something that has been always been popular with American audiences. I mean, even just with, like, Cyndi Lauper in the 80s, you know, really good example of that, right? Big 80s artist who was a teenage girl singing about boys. You know, in the late 90s, you also had Britney Spears, who was a teenage girl, and she was a teen idol. And, you know, and a little bit later on in the 2000s, you had Hilary Duff. And then in more recent years, if you're a millennial, I'm sure you know about Miley Cyrus, who was one of the biggest American teenage girl idols of the past, like, you know, 10 years. And right now you have Billie Eilish and more recently Olivia Rodrigo. And all the one thing that all those girls have in common is that they were all, they're all teenage. I mean, Miley Cyrus and Hilary Duff aren't teenagers anymore. They're much older than that. But at the time they were teenagers, and right now, and Billie Eilish, when they were was a teenager, and so was Olivia Rodrigo. So the point I'm trying to make is that when all those female artists had massive success in the pop charts, they were all the same age as Leslie Gore. And they all kind of had the same angle of, you know, girls singing about boys, but really, you know, it was, there were some artists that, you know, that kind of just, you know, ventured out of that. But still, I mean, like, even like Billie Eilish, for instance, I mean, like, you know, one of her biggest hit songs was a song called Bad Guy. And, you know, obviously she's referring to a dude, she's talking about a man. So, I mean, this the sort of thing about, you know, girls singing about boys is something that has always sort of continued into right now. I mean, it's obvious, like, you know, even like Olivia Rodrigo, a song she just put out had a huge hit with called Driver's License. I mean, basically, that's, you know, she's singing about her ex-boyfriend. I mean, this whole sort of girl group style, even though it's evolved and we don't really have the whole sort of thing that was going on in the 60s, I mean, the whole concept of it, of a girl singing about teenage boys, still continues on to this day. And Leslie Gore is sort of the OG sort of girl teen idol of, you know, before any of those people I just mentioned. She was one of the very first ones. And she was born in 1946, and she grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and she, you know, she was raised in New Jersey, so she kind of grew up in the New York, New Jersey, tri-state area, so that's kind of where she grew up. And it's so fascinating, because the guy that produced Leslie Gore, I guarantee you, you'll know him. He is a very, very big name, and this might surprise you, because once I drop this name, you'll be like, what? He produced this artist? Oh my God, like, holy shit. Like, this might surprise you, because this person who produced Leslie Gore has continued to stay relevant within the music industry. And he is somebody that is one of the richest musicians on the planet. I mean, this guy is universally well known everywhere. He is so big, and he continues to nurture brand new talent into the world. And he is one of the most world renowned, most well respected, most insanely talented musicians, but also producers, composers. I mean, this guy's huge. And this guy produced Leslie Gore. And once I mention his name, you'll be like, oh my God, I'm just like, wow, he produced Leslie Gore. Well, guess what? He did. And a lot of people don't realize this. Before, he produced, you know, all the big artists that he produced in the 80s and 90s and even in the 70s, I mean, all before he did all the film composing, he produced Leslie Gore. And I'm going to mention his name right now, and then I'm going to get into, well, actually, So Leslie Gore, you know, was basically, you know, she grew up in New York City, tri-state area, you know, New Jersey, sort of that sort of area, right? And then when she became a teenager, she got signed to Mercury Records. And I'm not sure exactly who signed her, but it was probably Shelby Singleton. He probably signed Leslie Gore to Mercury Records. And she was just a teenager at the time. So, I mean, she was really young, still in high school. She was like 16 years old. And this was in 1963. And then she got a hold of a song called It's My Party. And when at the time, Leslie Gore was a young, you know, musician, very talented, really good singer, but she also knew more about music theory than your average teen idol. I mean, she had an ear for certain things. She was very musically gifted in a sense. And then basically what happened was that Shelby Singleton decided, you know what, I'm going to pair up Leslie Gore with an up and coming guy who has done a lot of jazz sessions, you know, for a couple different labels. But he's been with us for a while. He's been doing hundreds of jazz sessions for us for Mercury. I'm gonna set him up with Leslie and see how this is gonna work. Let's see what the partnership is gonna be like. Well, that person that produced Leslie Gore and had humongous success with Leslie Gore was Quincy Jones. So yes, Lee Quincy Jones, who produced Michael Jackson's Thriller and composed the music for the Austin Powers movie, and the guy who also discovered Jacob Collier and is basically nurturing him right now. This guy produced Leslie Gore. Yes. So, you know, and this was very interesting because it was a weird partnership because Leslie Gore was a young up and coming, you know, teenage girl singer from Brooklyn, New York, who also grew up in New Jersey. And Quincy Jones was a guy in at this point he was in his 30s, and he was a jazz musician from Chicago who worked with Dizzy Gillespie and so many other different musicians. And, you know, it was a weird partnership because a lot of people thought, okay, how is this going to work? I mean, Quincy Jones is a huge jazz musician, and he's working with Leslie Gore, and these songs aren't necessarily jazz songs. These are like simple 3 or 4 chord pop songs. But somehow, they got along quite well because it was almost kind of like a father-daughter kind of relationship happening. But it was more, but the thing is that, you know, Quincy was an insanely talented, still is an insanely talented producer and, you know, arranger. And I mean, even though the thing is that it was Quincy Jones producing, right? He brought in all of his jazz musicians who played on, who played on his sessions for Mercury. And honestly, I don't know who played on Leslie Gore stuff, but I would imagine it was probably the same musicians who played on his jazz sessions for Mercury. He brought in all those great jazz musicians to play on his stuff, play on her stuff. And then he brought in a German composer / arranger named Klaus Ogerman to arrange those records. And that team of Quincy Jones producing, Klaus Ogerman arranging, and Leslie Gore singing was just the dream team. I mean, that they recorded so many hits together. And the first one, It's My Party, was recorded at Bell Sound Studios, which is the address is 22237 West 54th Street. So that's where they first, that was the first hit, It's My Party. And there's a long story about how that record, you know, actually got into the hands of Leslie Gore. I mean, first it was recorded by Barbara Jean English as a demo, and then it got recorded by, Helen Shapiro, and then it got released in England first. It didn't really do anything. And then basically it got back once it became in England, and then the song got back to Leslie Gore, and basically the demo wound up in the maybe pile that Leslie Gore listened to and was like, you know what, I like this, but I'll put it in the maybe pile. So they were listening to a bunch of demos, and basically when Leslie Gore says, you know what, let's do It's My Party for the next session, and you know, when that happened, essentially the Aaron Schroeder, who basically owned the publishing for It's My Party, because it was a song written by his songwriters, John Gluck, Wally Gold, Herb Weimer, and Seymour Gottlieb. And by the way, Seymour Gottlieb was an old guy who had a 16-year-old daughter, and the 16-year-old daughter was upset that her, you know, her is, you know, her, is, uh, his, her grandparents had to show up to the Sweet 16 party, and she didn't want the grandparents being there, so she said, like, literally, it's my party, and I'll cry if I want to. And that's when he wrote down lyrics for the song, and that's basically he teamed up with John Gluck Weigel, her writer, to write that song. And then basically, you know, what happened was that what Aaron Schroeder didn't tell Quincy Jones was that Phil Spector had heard the demo for It's My Party and decided, you know what, I'm going to record this with the Crystals. And then Quincy Jones didn't know that that Phil Spector was going to record the song, the Crystals, until they randomly ran into each other at a concert at the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. I think it was at Carnegie Hall. They both were at a concert together, Carnegie Hall, seeing the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. And Phil Spector was like, hey, man, you heard this song called It's My Party? It's great. I'm going to go back to L.A. and record with the Crystals. And then Quincy Jones was like, holy shit, what? Oh, my God, I have to record this immediately. So he immediately booked studio time at Bell Sound Studios on March 30th, 1963, to record the song with Leslie Gore. And I don't know who's playing on this session. I don't know. I've always wondered, like, who played on these Leslie Gore records, but I really have no idea. I mean, it was probably the same musicians that played on his jazz stuff. I don't know. I don't even know who's singing background on that, but those are really good background vocals. And basically, when he found out that Phil Spector wanted to produce the song with the Crystals, I know Gary Chester's playing drums on that. I know that for a fact, but I don't know who else is on the session. But anyways, when Quincy Jones found that out, he basically rushed to release the song. He literally cut the record at Bell Sound Studios on March 30th, and then like a week later, he took that master tape that he recorded, that reel-to-reel master tape that he recorded at Bell Sound, and went to the vinyl pressing plants I think it was at the same studio, and basically made test pressings of the record. And I think they recorded a couple other songs at session for the B-side, and basically it came out in April of 1963. And then by June, it was in the top 10. It was a number one record. And then Leslie Gore, at that point, would eventually go from being 16 to 17. But the song was a number one record. And it was her very first single was a number one song, which is really crazy. I mean, there's not too many artists that did that. But yeah, I mean, after that, she was kind of off to the races. Her next single, Jews to the Cry, which was actually the sequel to It's My Party. It was the answer song to it. It was written by different writers, not the same writers that wrote It's My Party, but actually Edna Lewis and Beverly Ross wrote Jews to the Cry, also writers from 1650 Broadway. And then also Mark Barkin and Ben Rowley wrote She's a Fool. I interviewed Mark Barkin on my podcast, and he told a really cool story behind She's a Fool. If you want to hear that, please go back and listen to it. It's really, really good. I really enjoyed hearing that story behind that song. I wish I could have him on again, but he has unfortunately passed away. But he also wrote That's the Way Boys Are. And then Leslie Gore recorded her signature song that I'm sure you know about, You Don't Owe Me. And that's kind of an interesting song, how she got a hold of it. Because basically, John Madera and David White wrote the song. Yes, the song was written by two dudes, I know. But anyways, it was written by John Madera and David White. And they wanted someone else to record it, or they didn't initially want Leslie Gore to do it. But what happened was that they presented the song to her when Leslie Gore was vacationing with her family at the Catskills Mountains in New York, which is in upstate New York where the Hamptons is. Leslie Gore heard the song from the two writers, and she actually liked it. And, you know, she realized that, look, I can't be singing about these teenage girls, the songs where I'm basically a teenage girl and, like, you know, like I'm a pushover these guys. I can't be singing these kind of songs anymore. I need something different. And that's what inspired her to record You Don't Own Me. And You Don't Own Me was a very big hit for her in late 63, early 64. It was actually number two when I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles, number one. So it was in the charts the same time as the Beatles. And, she did pretty well even after the British invasion. I mean, that's the way Boys Are did okay. But also, her biggest hit, the summer of 64, was Maybe I Know, which was written by the same writers who wrote Look of Love. The song was written by Jeff Perry and Nellie Greenwich. Jeff Perry and Nellie Greenwich were writers for Trio Music. If you don't know who we are, I'm sure you know the song Be My Baby. Yes, they wrote that for the Ronettes. They also wrote a bunch of other songs. Do-Wah Diddy by Manfred Mann. Chapel of Love by the Dixie Cups, Do Run Run by the Crystals. I mean, like, they wrote tons and tons of hit songs. Burvard Deep Mountain High by Ike and Tina Turner. They were very, very successful. And again, you know, they were Brill Building songwriters. They had their own group together called the Raindrops. And they were very, very successful. And I actually want to play for you one of the original demo version of Look of Love, because it's on YouTube. You can hear the original demo version of Ellie Greenwich. And I kind of want to show you what the original version of Look of Love sounded like as a demo before it got recorded by Quincy Jones and Leslie Gore. And just to hear that musically it's not that different from the original master recording by Leslie Gore. Here's what the original demo sounded like. Wow. Notice how the original demo sounded just like the original master recording by Leslie Gore. It's the same song, really. I mean, even the same chord changes, the same, you know, the lyrics are exactly the same. Everything's the same. I've heard the full length demo, and she did change Quincy Jones did change the lyrics for the bridge, but other than that, it's the same song. I mean, even Leslie Gore kind of just sort of copied her vocal style a little bit. I mean, I will say this, Ellie Greenwich was also a very good background singer. She was an incredible background singer. I mean, she sang Background of Respect by Aretha Franklin and a couple of other hits too. I mean, she was a very, very good background singer, and I think she's singing background on the master recording of Look of Love, you know, with Quincy Jones producing, Klaus Sugarman arranging. By the way, there are, like I said before, early Leslie Gore hits were Credit Bell Sound Studios on 54th Street. Then they went over to A&R on 48th Street. The original address of the studio was 112 West 48th Street, literally on 7th Avenue, right where the Metropole was, big jazz club in New York City. You know, basically that's where Quincy Jones produced most of her hits, like Sunshine, Lollipops, and Rainbows, She's a Fool, You Don't Own Me. I mean, most of her big hits were recorded at A&R Studios. The first couple were done at Bell Sound. I think It's My Party was cut at Bell Sound, and Jews Did a Cry might have been at A&R or Bell Sound. But most of the early stuff was cut at Bell Sound, and then she quickly switched over to A&R, you know, when Quincy Jones moved over to that studio. And then also, later on, Quincy Jones stopped working with Leslie Gore, and he, you know, became producing Frank Sinatra's concerts in Vegas, and, you know, became a hugely successful, composer for film and TV. So, Leslie Gore later on to go with Bob Crewe. Bob Crewe actually produced a very big hit for Leslie, California Nights. Now, one really other cool writing credit that Leslie Gore had, that a future songwriter, a big hit songwriter for Barbra Streisand, his name is Marvin Hamlisch. He wrote Sunshine, Lollipops, and Rainbows, which Marvin Hamlisch's uncle was Quincy Jones' dentist, and that's how they were able to get songs to Quincy Jones. Quincy Jones' dentist was Marvin Hamlisch's uncle. So Sunshine, Lollipops, and Rainbows was a big hit for Leslie Gore. It was written by Marvin Hamlisch and Howard Lederberg. They also wrote California Nights, which is a big hit for Arne later on in 67, after Quincy Jones stopped producing for her and Bob Crewe took over. And I believe that one was kind of Mirror Sound Studios, because that's where Bob Crewe was producing most of his hits at the time, out of his Mirror Sound. So, yeah, I mean, Leslie Gore's career kind of teared off in the late 60s. She stopped having hits. And one more bombshell thing I want to tell you about Leslie Gore before I end this podcast is that she was gay. Yes, Leslie Gore was totally lesbian. And she didn't come out until many, many years later, until the 2000s. So, I mean, for years, nobody really knew that, but it's kind of interesting to think about, because she was singing about boys even though she was gay. And this is kind of interesting because, like, you know, it was very difficult for gay people to be accepted back then. You know, lesbian women and gay guys were very tough to accept people like that back then. So, but it was a different time, and I'm sure if she came up right now, it would be completely different. But I mean, that's just the way things were back then. But yes, she was gay. And it's kind of surprising to think about it because she was singing about guys, you know, most of her songs. And I mean, she had a wife and, you know, I mean, she was totally gay. But yeah, so hope you find that interesting. And that concludes this week's episode. Also, Phil Ramone engineered a lot of Leslie Gore's early stuff at A&R. And he actually later went go on to produce Billy Joel. Yeah, that Phil Ramone. He engineered most of Leslie Gore's early stuff at A&R. And yeah, and also, just a quick little recap on what happened later on to Leslie Gore. She unfortunately got lung cancer and she passed away about like 6 years ago. So actually more, I think it might be more like seven, because 2015 was 7 years ago, I think. So, yeah, she passed away a long time ago, lung cancer, and I never got to see her play live. And you know, she was only like 69. She was like 69 years old when she passed away, so she wasn't even that old, to be honest with you. And you know, I mean, I hope that I get to meet Quincy Jones one day and I get to pick his brain about Leslie and the recording sessions that he did with her and the studio musicians that he used, because I've always wondered about that. I've never known who these musicians were. I'm assuming they're the same jazz cats that he used on the Mercury sessions. You know, the Mercury jazz stuff, I'm assuming it's the exact same musicians, but I don't know. Because I think that's probably true, because I don't think the younger demo session players from New York, like Artie Butler and Al Gorgoni and guys like that, and Artie Kaplan, wound up playing on Leslie Gore sessions, because Quincy was the man, and he, you know, he liked to use his jazz players on his stuff. So I'm assuming that he used the exact same jazz musicians on, you know, that he used for the jazz sessions for Leslie Gore's records. But I don't know. Hopefully one day I get to ask him that. But, you know, I don't know, to be honest with you. I mean, like, Quincy is so huge, and, you know, I don't know how much longer he's going to be around for. And he's such a big, huge person that, it, you know, he seems like almost next to impossible to get a hold of. But maybe we'll see. I mean, I might put that out there to the universe that one day I'll get to talk to him. I'll get to pick his brain about Leslie Gore sessions. But I mean, to be honest with you, he's the only person alive that would know actually who played on her stuff, because Klaus Ogerman passed away. And Leslie Gore is also gone, so, you know, he's the only one left that could actually tell people who played on her stuff. So, but we'll see. I mean, but anyway, so that concludes part two of episode 174 of my 16 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I am Sam Williams, and if you learned some fascinating information about, you know, Leslie Gore from listening to this podcast, and you didn't know anything about her, but you know that song, You Don't Own Me, just because it's such a huge song. I think it's gotten a remix recently. It's a big, big record. I'm sure you know it. But if you never knew much about her and you found this is a really fascinating podcast and you learned a lot about her, please email me at samltwilliamicloud.com. You can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies, and check out more of my original music at samwilliamsmusic.net. Things you can check out in the description of this episode of this podcast are the EP you put out last year. Please go check it out. But I will say that this is actually kind of cool. So as I was recording this podcast, the lead guitar for the extended remix of, this, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a remix, but the lead guitar for take two, the extended version of Turquoise Apricot, was laid down as I was recording this podcast. So it's official now. Everything is recorded except for lead vocals and background vocals. So the next session I'm going to do, which I'm hoping will be very, very soon, and it probably will be very, very soon, all you need to do is just put lead vocals and some background vocals on, and then the EP is done recording-wise. This has been a very productive last couple months. We've done I think we've done at least three or four sessions a month, and these sessions have been very productive. We've gotten a lot of stuff done, and these songs sound amazing. So, I mean, you're definitely going to want to pre-save this EP before it's out. So, but for now, you can check out the last one. The link to that is in the description of this episode of this podcast. Definitely know what you think of that one. Please email me at samltwilliamicloud.com. You can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies, but definitely look out for the next EP because it's going to sound amazing. Okay, so now other things you can check out in the description of this episode of this podcast are the two interviews I did last year with Hawk Magazine, Shout Out LA. I mean, I'm hoping to do more interviews this year, but I honestly haven't gotten hit up by any publications, so I don't know if I'm going to do any more interviews this year. I mean, I should probably start posting more on a regular basis on Instagram, and, you know, just so that way I can at least get the attention of some of these publications, because to be honest with you, how I got the Honk Magazine write-up was because of someone hitting me up on Instagram. And they were obviously seeing what I was doing by all the posts I was doing. And I was posting for a while on Instagram pretty aggressively. But I've kind of stopped recently because I've just been so busy with other stuff. I've kind of gotten lazy with posting on Instagram. So you know how that is. I mean, if you're on Instagram a lot, you know, it's hard to think of like what to post next or what pictures, photos and videos to post next. I mean, like, try not to post something you've already posted. I mean, like, it's a whole ordeal with posting on Instagram, so I've been kind of lazy with posting on there lately. So maybe if I post more on Instagram, I'll get more interviews lined up, and I'll be able to talk with more publications. But I mean, we'll see. But yeah, I mean, other than, please go check that out. Definitely read those interviews, because I talked a lot about myself in those interviews, and you'll learn a lot about me from reading those interviews. But yeah, definitely let me know what you think of those interviews at samltwilliamicloud.com. You can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. And you can also follow me on TikTok, too, at iHeartOldies. I've been posting on there pretty frequently, too. That's another cool little platform you can follow me on if you want updates on what's happening with me and my music, too. But, of course, you know, you guys are always going to get the latest and greatest from me on this podcast. So don't worry about that. So, also, check out the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. There you'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about my show so far, but not the songs from the premium subscription version of this podcast I talk about in there. I'm not too sure if I want to include the songs on the premium subscription version on these playlists. I don't know. I mean, I might create another playlist. We'll see. But I'll definitely keep you guys posted about that. But anyways, go follow and listen to those playlists, and that should give you ideas for the kind of songs to talk about on my show. And hopefully you have some more suggestions for me for songs to talk about next to my podcast that I haven't yet. And if you do have any suggestions for me, please email me at samltwilliamicloud.com. You can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies and TikTok, too, at the same username. Also, the music video for Keeper in My Back Pocket, please go check that out. I did shoot another music video, but the thing is that I'm re-recording Turquoise Apricot, and the re-recorded version sounds a million times better than the original recording. So what might happen is that we might try to sync up that version of Turquoise Apricot with the music video, the footage that we shot. I don't think that's happened yet, because the new recording of Turquoise Apricot, that is still happening. It's not finished yet. All you need to put down is lead vocals. That's the only thing that needs to happen now. But then once the lead vocals are done, then the song can be mixed and mastered. And maybe what will happen is that with the new music video that we shot of Turquoise Apricot, maybe we can sync that up with the music video footage that we shot. So we'll see. I mean, I'll definitely keep you guys posted on that, but definitely email me and let me know what you think of the Keeper in My Back Pocket music video, because that's a personal favorite off of my last EP. And I don't have any personal favorites off of this next one, but I hope you guys enjoy those songs. They're going to sound amazing. The production quality on these records is through the roof. It's so, so good. You're definitely going to love these songs. They're going to sound great. But yeah, so email me at samltwilliamicloud.com. Let me know what you think of those, that music video. Also, follow me on Instagram at iHeartOldies, and reach out to me on Instagram too. You can always DM me. I'm always on there. And, you know, follow me on TikTok too. You can find me on there and reach out to me on there as well. Same username as Instagram, iHeartOldies. Also, check out the Redbubble merch store I have with this podcast, and link to that in the description of this episode of this podcast. Please go do that. We'll love it if you can, you could definitely, you know, check out the merch store. Let me know what you think of the price of each item in the store and the logo itself. I don't really have a new logo for this podcast. I still have the same sort of thing that is on there right now, because I kind of like the logo that's up there right now. I could probably use another one, but I'm stumped. I don't know what else to come up with as far as, you know, I could probably come up with some other cool catchphrases. for this podcast, but I just, you know, I'm kind of lazy when it comes to that. So who knows? Maybe I'll come up with more logos for this podcast and there'll be more merch you guys could purchase. But for now, check out the one that's in the description of this episode of this podcast. Definitely know what you think of that logo plus the price of each item in the store. And I know that things are very, very expensive now. Look, I'm fully aware of the fact that inflation is at an all-time record high right now. Things are very, very expensive. You know, and I might try to adjust the prices of the merch items in my store, you know, just to see if that would get you guys interested in buying more merch. But I mean, we'll see. If you guys want me to do that, definitely let me know. Email me at samltwilly@icloud.com. You can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. And also, definitely check out the premium subscription version of this podcast, because you do not want to miss out on this. These are amazing interviews I'm doing with these legendary, you know, musicians from the 60s on my podcast, on the premium subscription version. So there's four out right now. There's one with the two guys from Icy Sand Fruitgum Company. There's the two-part interview with Felix Cavalieri, lead singer, principal songwriter, and keyboard player for the Rascals. And there's one out with Stan Ziska, background singer for Dion. But there's two more coming out very, very soon. One with Don Daneman, lead singer and guitar player for The Circle, and Al Gorgoni, lead session guitar player, or rhythm session guitar player. He did both lead and rhythm. So he was a New York guy, he has a lot of really cool stories. Please go subscribe to the premium subscription for his podcast, because one, you don't want to miss out on these interviews. These interviews are fantastic. And two, every premium subscriber I get will help me pay for next year too. So, and you guys get 2 months free, and it's $4.99 a month. So, I mean, it's really inexpensive. So you definitely, you know, I don't see why you guys can't afford that. I mean, it's very, very inexpensive, and you get 2 months free. So please go do that. So definitely let me know when you do that. When you check that out. And yeah, I mean, also, like, all the interview episodes are going to be there from now on. I'm not going to do free interview episodes right now. That's just not where my head is at right now with my podcast. You know, all the interview episodes are going to be on this premium feed. So these are all these free episodes you're listening to. They're all going to be solo episodes. So just keep that in mind. So if you want to check out any interview episodes I'm going to do in the future and right now in the future, definitely subscribe to the premium subscription version of this podcast, and a link to that is in the description of this episode of this podcast. So yeah, so I am Sam Williams, and thank you guys for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please keep things groovy.